Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Well, I think it's often missed that in a lot of cases, you know, as you look at the decision making process, people are afraid to make the wrong decision, so end up making no decision, which in most cases is actually worse
exactly
than if you made the wrong decision.
Exactly.
You can get into analysis paralysis and end up resulting in nothing.
It's a very interesting analysis paralysis.
Well, yeah, and DLP is such a monster anyway. If you don't do the prep work right.
Right. And looking at the prep work itself, because I know traditionally we've always gone about, well, you've got to get to data classification first. Is that the case? As you look at the evolution of some of our tools that we're starting to hone in on, that if you just focus on data classification, labeling of documents, and then watching kind of where they're going, being edited and all of that, that you tend to generate a lot of noise. There's a lot of false positives as part of that. But I'm seeing more of a shift now to, all right, well, now let's just focus on risky behaviors, that we know that these are your couple of critical systems. I don't have to get into the sub detail of what data classifications are in them, but I do know that a document came from here and is now going to a private email address. That behavior is now risky and probably has a higher level of propensity for being a true positive.
So you're saying the tool sets today, looking at behavior itself,
you're
right?
Reframing like, the risk.
So this person is sending something to this person, but his normal location is, say, Michigan. And look at this. All of a sudden, he's sending it from South America to this other location. But why is he in South America, right? Like those type of tools, looking at those behaviors.
So, yeah, you're spot on, kind of taking a step back and more holistic view of actual behavior as opposed to the metadata on a given document that's moving around. Not saying there's not a place for some of the data classification, but I almost wonder if there's a more efficient way we can do it, in at least in some of the less regulated verticals, right? I don't think that changes in a financial world and some of those.
No. But two things. I define the prep work a little differently. The prep work is understanding not the data itself, not the classification, but where do you expect it to be going? Because the one thing I found, and I'm finding myself in yet another one of these systems, one of the projects I just got asked to work on is a fraud identification system. So it's building it for, you know, we can't buy a product, we've got to build it because it's very specific. And realizing that there's a whole host of fraud already within normal. So if you start to look at what normal is, you've got a significant amount of data transfer. I mean, again, this is back to perfect is the enemy of good, but you know, getting started, yes. But as part of it, I think less important than what is the data and how is it classified is what is moving where. And are we okay with that? Every time I try something with normalcy involving geographies, involving people, there's not enough data that's accurate in order to be able to let me do that. And 20 minutes in, inevitably we hit a, why did my thing get stopped? And you find that there's some cockamamie, you know, IP address just cannot be used for geography information.
Yeah,
unless you're taking actual geo. I guess geo is where this all falls down for me, unless I'm taking actual GPS information. And it's happened 5 times now in my life.
I think I still think geography is an important part of the equation to
at least watch some of it. I'm just saying it's going to bite you in the ass.
I totally.
Because the tech is not there to do it. Like impossible travel is the worst thing to implement because I end up spending more time overcoming the fact that impossible travel was impossibly wrong in how it assessed things.
But I think it's interesting because if you put that in the context and looking at the evolution of our controls, at one point, geo was a good piece of data that we used to generate actions upon, right? Mm-hmm. And then as you look at the shift of the attackers, all of a sudden, and you know, I've seen this in the past, that you'll see infrastructure that all of a sudden gets stood up in the city right next to where they're attacking. So now this isn't a geographical issue. It's right there. But same thing I've seen that you were talking about, Dan, is that a lot of the metadata around that, the classification around what IP addresses, where people are coming from, is not as good as it probably should be.
And you're seeing, you know, this is the place again where privacy and security have come together to nuke each other in the backside. We've got more users using things that move their IP addresses around in the name of privacy. And therefore, you can't count on the location that you think you're seeing for somebody.
Right.
We've got normal users. It used to be only technologists were the only ones that were playing around with VPNs and with different exit points. But now you've got it built into browsers by default. You've got VPNs on every laptop so people can get around licensing restrictions, or just to get them out of the hotel safely, or to get them into a one of the pick your branded acronym for cloud-based VPN that gets you corporate cloud-based VPN that gets you back to your corporate network, but without traditional hardware. All of those things are making it more difficult to count on that kind of information. And oh, by the way, I flipped this on. Now I just instantly traveled from Michigan to Japan to Britain because I'm bouncing all over the place.
Right. Well, that's interesting, kind of sidestep, kind of sort of related, but just looking at the, so RFC 1918 space, so right, private IP space versus anything that is publicly routable across the internet. We're going through a process and starting to look at, because now with some of the evolution of some of these tools, you can see here are my protected devices. Here are devices that are close by that could be protected, right? So looking at what's that drift from our protection rollout. In a work from home scenario though, all of a sudden you start picking up on all of these home networks, everything else that's going on. So all of a sudden red lights going off that, hey, you've got all these devices have to be protected. That's a home printer. What the heck? It becomes very, it's completely changed that game in this new environment.
Absolutely. Well, that's why everybody feared the securing of the remote, workers so badly that it often hampered telecommuting programs up until 2 years ago. And then there was really no choice.
Look at General Motors when Mary Barra was doing her keynote for CES. That was, 4 days, 5 days before CES, all of a sudden it was announced that it was going to be done virtually, and most of the OEs, the management couldn't travel because of the Omicron. So she's 2 minutes into the speech and it's, over 50% of GMs listening and they're all VPN'd in and it's taking their system down. She stopped her speech to say, everybody from General Motors, please get off VPN and log back in. Imagine being the CISO listening to your CEO tell your entire company, please feel free to get off and get back on, because we got to finish this, right?
Right.
Interesting. That is really interesting.
But this, and I was bringing this up for 2 points. One is, 100-year-old manufacturer, right? And they're full tunnel. You go back, and I was thinking in regards to classification of data, and for these older companies that have been around, for 100 years. The move to the cloud, and tell me if I'm wrong, could be a good opportunity to begin classifying some of your data, because there are tools, solutions, products, people that as you're moving things into the cloud, you can begin to say, hey, this is my time when I'm cleaning out the closet, that as I clean it out, I can begin to classify things.
Right.
And I don't have to spend, going through every piece of clothing. I know that this is, 4-year-old clothing. I know this stuff's the really important. These are the Z Cavaricis from 20 years ago. Those are worth a dollar, And yes, I did bring up Z Cabarici's inside this podcast.
That's okay.
That is phenomenal.
We seek to expand our scope.
This is kind of the debate that you and I have had before, Dan, on moving everything to the cloud versus on-prem, kind of looking at centralizing everything in one central location in the cloud creates a bigger target versus what can I do in a cloud environment that is cost prohibitive in an internal environment and building out the compute, the storage, and all of that.
What's the maturity of your ability to protect your own infrastructure internally versus that which comes from the massive scale of public cloud service providers? And granted, that doesn't help you all the way up the stack, but it's you certainly get some huge benefits from being in the public cloud.
With some drawbacks, right? Because I do think that a lot of SaaS cloud services, somebody else's computer, whatever you want to use as your term there, almost lulls a lot of people into a false sense of security that I don't have to worry about business continuity. I don't have to worry about disaster recovery, any of these tenants, because they've got it there. We've got a contract in place. I think that we're going to see more and more. I mean, I'm going to pick on Kronos this year. That was a big one at the end of the year. And what happened?
It still is a big one.
Still is. Yes. But that's a big provider that would have had good controls in place, processes and all that. And look at how hard they got hit that they're rebuilding. I think that we're going to start seeing as we go into 2022, that more giants being targeted just for that huge return on those environments where we're all consolidating.
Oh, I think that, yeah, well, absolutely. And you can't just say I'm going to cloud services and boom, it all fixes it. Everything fixes itself because you put it there. And that is a fallacy that I guess I had hoped we had come beyond. But you know, correct me if I'm being naive, that there are still organizations that think cloud equals instant, all upside, no downside. In the interactions I've had, it seems like that is becoming more understood, that there are risks, there's more visibility, there's a whole different learning curve. But there are some significant benefits when you want to scale, when you want somebody to be building great data centers, you know, those kind of things that aren't as efficient for you to do yourself.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely a trade-off.
So going back to the question that one of our listeners had asked too, though, because like the second we talk about, because we're talking about data and it was on-prem or in the cloud. And again, we're talking about two different locations and the different perimeters, I guess you could say, that are built there around it and how you protect it and the different layers, right? And Eric, I think he even alluded to the fact that the protecting with layers, right? And sometimes part of this process is peel back the layers. And he said, well, what if you just got to the data itself and instead of the outside in approach, start with the data approach. And then, you know, we started talking about DLP and then, well, you have to classify the data. Well, that's a whole nother basket that we were talking about. But what other approaches can you take to saying if we start with the data first, like encryption, other things that you can do with your own data before you're even saying I'm building a wall around it, making it harder for even my own company to get at it?
Yeah. I mean, I think if we're going to do the alternative approach, where can we focus our time to curb some of that risk without getting into the minutia of data classification, building out DLP programs? So kind of the quick steps, right?
Yes, but I think that the intent of this post, so just so everybody knows, this is a response we got from a listener who was commenting about our discussion about Log4j and the ability to protect things from the outside in. But the comment is, I'd like to hear a conversation about how to approach data security from a data first perspective. So it's to use, Silicon Valley, the show, an outside in or an inside out approach. taking the data as the center of the world versus infrastructure.
I could see that. I mean, for me, my perspective, though, I don't see those as being kind of binary. You're choosing one or the other. I think there's a melding of the two together, right? Because a system only comes into scope. So for instance, I'll take a step back. So one of the things that we focus on is what we call our crown jewels. And I know that's kind of a dated terminology now, going hearkening back to the castle, the moat, and all of those things. But in either case, I think you get the concept that it's the most critical items that we need to focus on. That is a business-driven decision that we, with the enterprise risk management team, that we meet annually to define what should we be concerned about. That creates a risk profile. Within that risk profile, you have systems and data, and the two are harmonious. They work together, right? Because as you start to look at the most critical data, the most critical data comes from somewhere. There is a system of record, and then there is a typical storage, and you're kind of defining the elements of that data. But you, I think if you look at just one or the other, just on its own, you miss.
That's an interesting point, because especially with the log4j conversation, because rather than just talking about crown jewel data, but data as you're building, and this goes back to log4j, right? So using open source software technology to build upon, right? There's data from that that maybe is not what you're calling your crown jewels, because you're developing applications and programs that's developing crown jewels, things that your business drives on and makes money from. But the data and the ability to trace back the steps, it's like going into, I'm going to pivot to automotive engineering, right? Understanding that you have every change point that you've made on the drawing, right? This is level A, level B, level C. Here was a major change, so it changed the entire part number, and then it started over with levels A, B, C. You can go back and clearly see, like, hey, well, what happened 15 years ago on this vehicle, on this part? And you're going through the drawing changes, you can see that. When you get into some of the software builds that were done 10, 15, 20 years ago, there's not as much traceability. And that's, I think, some of the effect that people are seeing with log4j. So where I'm hearkening this to is, it's not just, if we look at it from a data perspective, it's not, and I'm not saying, oh, well, we should be holding data for 20 years. That's not what I'm saying here. But the ability to have traceability, right, that I think more people are talking about now as they do builds, et cetera, that data accessible. And that data can be security related data, because when a vulnerability like this comes up, your ability to go back quickly, right, no perimeter was going to stop. No, you could have the tallest walls in the world. It's internal vulnerability. And I wonder if that is where part of the question is coming from, or the point is being made around, let's talk about the data that's now being generated, because that data is being generated from software.
Somewhat. I think yes, but there's also, though, this underpinning this has nothing to do with security data, in my view. This has to do with data. And the fact that data is usually not the center of the universe when it comes to product development, when it comes to deployment, it's not, let's start with the data and build the systems around it and the protections around it and manage the data from the middle out. And that is actually because at some point that becomes, you know, back to the point we were talking about earlier, why DLP becomes a challenge, data loss prevention, if you're not in the security realm, that classification becomes such a challenge because it is often put on the too hard pile. It is looking at the data you have and reasonably defining it, reasonably keeping inventory of it and the way it's used and flows through systems is a very difficult problem. It doesn't happen easily. And when you get to the point where you're deploying something, you're just like, oh, we'll just deploy the system and we'll put the data, we'll just store it, and then we'll figure it out later. Because getting to production, getting something out there is usually a bigger deal than understanding the data that comes with it, because data still isn't seen in most cases as valuable to someone other than the business.
Right.
And so you think about it differently. You think about it as, you know, Kleenex. The Kleenex is always there, and it'll be there, and I'll pull it, and I'll get some more when I need more. But if you think about the Kleenex from the perspective of the tree, it's a bit different.
Right. And I'm just reading through the comment, and I think the data versus perimeter perspective, I think, again, I'm going to take the same approach, that it's got to come together. Right. I don't think we need to throw out our old ideas around building the perimeter, the layers of security. Can we call that like the security ogre, an onion? Like, how does that to do a defense, Shrek reference?
Defense in depth.
Yeah. I don't think we throw it out, but I think we reframe it. If we're looking holistically across the organization and try to protect everything at the same level, not feasible. But I do agree with the comment that on the data-centric approach, but that's where I think we're shifting the perimeter, that we're now almost talking about micro perimeters. And the micro perimeter is not just technology, but also controls, whether it be access controls, reviews on that, entitlements, all of those things. But that really is data-centric. And I really think for organizations, as we continue to grow, as the workforce becomes faster and faster, things become more mobile, we do have to shift to that data-centric approach, because we're now starting to see, I mean, look at anybody who's on the journey to modern workplace and all that with Microsoft, that you can join a computer from anywhere, you can image it, you can do all that. It's all connected. And then this gets into what we've talked about in the past about the zero trust model, then kind of creating that micro perimeter around the most critical data and systems, as opposed to one giant wall around everything.
Yeah. And if you take the everlasting gobstopper model that we've often talked about, moving from the old M&M model where it was crunchy on the outside and softer on the inside, now we've moved to something a little more like an everlasting gobstopper, which is layers of candy. And if you're watching this in the video version, I will now put up a picture of what I'm talking about. That we have this, these layers that come through, but at the middle, we've been shrinking the amount of the small, of that small middle that's squishy, but the data really does live at the middle of it. And if we continue to extend that defense in depth model all the way to the middle and truly harden the data at the center, meaning, you know, proper encryption from the beginning, that we do things like differential privacy so that we can segment the identifiable portions from the rest of the data. You know, there's a bunch of different methods to protect that data from the get-go. And therefore, but then you then have to build that into all your systems all the way out. And all those systems do then require a little more processing power, a little more time, and a little more consciously thought through data flow, because now you have to do more work on that data as it goes through. I think it's a really valid point. And, you know, looking at the data as for what it is, which is the thing that runs everything now, means to bring this back around to the DLP again, means that you really should do that level of classification, that level of understanding, that level of protection on the data from the beginning, and then define the appropriate flows so that it only goes to the places it should. Which is counter to what we talked about a couple of minutes ago, Eric, which was just start watching and see where the flows go and then assume that those are okay unless they're going to weird places.
Right.
See, and I don't envy the position that you guys are in, because I was taking a step back saying, well, here's your starting point. If you start here and begin doing some classification, begin taking a holistic view at all the different data you have, and then starting to put different, if you want to call them perimeters, barriers, as you build what's going to go to the cloud, what's not. But then I had to take a second to think about it and say, well, most of the time when people get to this point, it's when they say, hey, we need to build a security team. Because a company starts, a company begins to grow, as they begin to flourish, resources come into place. And before you know it, you really are growing. And right. Now you're like, oh, well, an issue pops up. And the first time you have an issue, it's like, okay, whack-a-mole, put it back down. But then it happens again. And before you know it, it's like, hey, we really need to get, you know, a security posture. And then by the time Eric arrives or Dan arrives, there's already data all over the place. There's systems that aren't really systems. It's just what people ended up doing because they were running now and not walking, right? As the business grew.
Right.
So yeah, I say this in one breath because I feel like the security leaders come into play and they're already behind the eight ball. The business isn't just going to stop, but at some point you do have to slow it down to speed it back up, right? Short-term pains for long-term gains. And I do think the approach of saying, guys, let's take a look at the data, right? Instead of jumping in, because I think the first thing is could be impulsory. Like someone comes in and says, okay, the first thing we need to do is build the biggest wall around this. We need to protect it. But then the second you do that, 10 years later, you realize how much technical debt you have, or call it any type of debt that you
have. There's no technical debt in manufacturing. What are you talking about?
No. I was referring to those other industries. But again, you know, I think it's a tough position that security professionals are put into, because by the time we need to put a security program in play, and even today when people are being more proactive with security because of the incidents that have occurred with, whether it's Log4j, whether it's ransomware, why are people very concerned with Log4j? Because of ransomware and other threat vectors that can be used to get into your environment. And then cyber insurance is increasing. So there's more of a focus from the business to do something on it. But if you come into this company that's got a very immature security program and that company's 60, 70 years old, it's very tough to drill all the way down into all that data, right? So, Well, on one side, I appreciate the question, right? And it is a very good one. And if you have the opportunity to say, yeah, let's step back and just look at the data. But many times you guys are coming in into a position where you are behind the eight ball.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think this also dovetails into a conversation we had last year on, I believe it was a Forrester report that came out with a different type of CISOs and organizations recognizing what you need. And the example that you're throwing out there, Brian, is a specific type of CISO to start building that program, helping the organization. That is a lot of conversations that have to be had to understand how security fits into everything, how it can be an enabler of the business, not just a hindrance. But I think from an organizational standpoint, it's super important that organizations realize where they are in the maturity journey. And that's the key thing, that security has got to be seen as a journey. It's not a checkbox activity. It's very easy to get caught up in, look at everything we've got to do. Come on, we got to start just making tactical decisions to curb this risk. And it just doesn't work that way. I'm not saying in the thick of it, you can't make quick decisions, that you need to quickly address certain risks, certainly with what happened with Log4j and all that, but recognizing security is an ingrained portion of, it is part of the business. It is the cost of doing business now, and it is a journey over time that is evolving.
And
100% agree.
And the other element I'll add to this is that I guess I'm delighted, and I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, but when you look at new organizations that are starting up, new startups, you actually are seeing information security requirements come earlier and earlier. There's a local CEO who asked me to provide a talk to his board about when is the right time to hire a CISO and when is the right time to bring information security into your small organization, you know, pre-seed and seed rounds of funding. And this is, like I said, 5 years ago, I wouldn't have said this. I think a lot of organizations, startups are seeing the importance of doing this early. One, because it adds, it has great positive impact evaluation. And because those that would seek to help you with exits, either a private equity or an acquisition or venture capital, or even, you know, going public, all of those have information security is, and risk, technology risk is a huge part of that process. And you will find yourself worth a lot more if you spend the time to do it up front. Back to our short-term pain, long-term gain discussion from a few episodes ago.
Let's diving a little bit deeper into that, because I believe if you're having a conversation with a startup, and let's change the, instead of a CISO, a CIO or somebody in a technical role, is there any debate there that they need somebody from a technical role that's defining the architecture, the infrastructure, the underlying underpinnings of the company?
Yes, of course. And I think in often cases they do that, because you'll see what's one of the first cut you in modern startups. What are the first two things? You have a CEO and a CTO, right?
Right.
You have some, some idea, and then you build it technically. And one of the people and is usually a little more business savvy, and the other one is a little more technical savvy. And I'm trying to think of the name of the book. I think it's called Rocket Power. It's called Rocket Power, in which it talks about this magic combination. I'll put a link in the show notes. This magic combination of two people that to bring a startup to fruition and growth. Someone who is more of a people side, and one that's a little bit more of a tech side, of a do side, or an operation side. And that's a magic combination. So I think, yeah, you're seeing that CTO, COO, CTO person show up very early.
Right. So as we look at that, I think the CTO position is a given now, right? That it's, you have to have those, both of those elements. I begin to wonder if at some point, and maybe this is already happening, that you're going to see that CTO, CIO, in smaller companies, I feel like sometimes those can still be interchangeable, start to meld together with the CISO, that you start seeing the CISO come over with that security perspective and finding, I don't know, maybe that's the unicorn that doesn't exist right now, but that person that understands both sides of the coin, that you have uptime, you have SLAs, you have features, but at the same time, you have controls and governance.
And this is going to harken back to another episode we had about who the CISO reports to. But Eric, I was thinking about, and this is all stemming from something you said maybe about 5 minutes ago, and it had to do with that the role of the security team and the CISO is ever changing, right? That it's not just putting controls in place and saying, yep, this is what's going to work for the next 10 years. And it got me thinking, again, pivoting back to automotive, when you put security checks, pokey oaks, and everything into an assembly line, right? Because you've designed this piece of equipment, this part that's going to come off. Those pokey oaks only work as long as you understand all the different failures that you believe you're going to have until a new failure pops up with a customer. And then you've got to go back, look at your process, and the people put in additional checks or design changes, right? But then when you get to the next major change, which is an entirely new door frame, an entirely new seat, all those security checks that you put in place were for that old seat. Right. So as your business continues to change and adapt, the security tools, processes, people have to adapt and change to whatever that new outcome is that the business is trying to do. That's why it will ever be ever changing. So right. Then I look at this and say, well, did the quality team, does the quality manager report to the production manager? No. And I can remember this back when I would visit the manufacturing plant, because there'd be arguments, well, quality's overthinking this. This isn't an issue of this. This is a design issue. And quality would say, well, no, it isn't. It's a manufacturing issue. And here's why. But if quality reported to manufacturing was always going to get their way.
No, it's interesting though. It's a good point, Brian. But I'll take the alternative to that. And I don't think the reporting relationship is necessarily as critical as we've made the topic, because I think it's depending on the organizational processes and structure. It's very possible to report to a CIO, and you could look at, all right, what are the tenets of each role? And we could say they're opposing objectives that they have, but there's more to the context, because there's many CISOs have a dotted line to an audit committee, to the board of directors, to other executives, that as long as those aren't shut off from helping the broader organization understand the risks, I don't think it matters as much where somebody reports. I feel like we've spent so much time focusing on that as an industry, not the three of us, but I just don't think it's that big of a deal.
Well, I think it was a necessary parable though to mm-hmm. tell for a long time, to make, you know, in order to get a point across, you sometimes have to take it to
fair enough
stream. You have to let the pendulum come out, and then it will swing back to a more natural middle state. And I think that is where that has happened. And actually, I think, again, a conversation I was having just this week around, could a leader, a technology leader with security background, be the joint CIO CISO?
Right.
And I think absolutely in the org, it depends, of course, on the organization and the people around it, and you know, the support structures, etc. But absolutely, the CIO can be both. It is not A, forbidden, B, necessarily a bad idea if you have that right person. And then in other cases, the other half of the discussion was, could the CIO report to the CISO? And I actually see that, as a really positive and interesting trend, because if you put, you know, if you say our primary goal, especially in organizations where the primary goal is data protection, is data integrity, and you know, those kind of things, then you know, that sends a pretty stark message. And I think it's one that would be well received and could execute right in the right organization.
Right. And then, I mean, again, there's context in that, because on the reporting relationship, if you're talking about an organization that's very data centric and what they're doing, oftentimes you're starting to see the growing role of a CDO, the chief data officer, that plays a role into that. But kind of going back to something, you know, Brian, that you're talking about, the evolutionary, the constant changing of what we're doing and controls today may not be necessary for tomorrow. I think that's got to be one of our focus points on, from a mindset, from a security practitioner, that we cannot get caught up in our own press clippings, right? That if you think about it, you launch this new project, greatest thing, you have to be willing to, in the short term, challenge it and tear it back down and realize what we did today is not what we need for tomorrow. And I think often as technologists, I guess as humans in general, it's very easy to get caught up in just loving what we've accomplished, that don't challenge it. That's my baby. And we have to be willing to change and constantly evolve, because the attackers are doing it beautifully.
Maybe this is where some ADD is helpful. You're like, I'm bored with this. Let's start over.
Right. And that's tough. I mean, we were having the conversation internally about the cost in doing that, right? That if you look at, there's a lot of time and effort that came into building out, just look at, let's put it in the context of a SIM, right? Onboarding the feeds, writing the use cases and all of that, and then transitioning to a new system. You know, Brian, you're talking about XDR and some of those different platforms, making those transitions, that it's very easy to get caught up and say, well, look at everything we're going to lose. All of that time is just lost. Well, that's sunk cost. We've already invested that, but there's also a cost, that avoidance that we achieve by having already done that work and moving to the new platform. We've gone through the process. We've identified those use cases. So the efficiency to migrate to a new platform should be quicker.
Eric, what you just did right there was basically take the learnings from the Infinite game and say, just because we accomplished this, was that the end, right?
Right.
Was it a finite goal, but always improving upon it? And at some point where you're at, you may decide, you know what? This was good, right? But this over here is much better. In order to do that, though, we have to restart again. And everyone says, well, wait, but we already put this much money into it. We already did this. We already did that. Right. But the risk of not doing it could be even greater, right?
Right.
And before you even began down that path, because I think it was great, I was actually going to bring up Kodak. And just the fact that you have all this data available, right? You have data that shows how much money you're making today. You have all this data that shows how you're basically plugged into every different part of the business, from where someone buys the camera to where they develop the camera to what the film's developed on. You have a path to profit on almost every part of film prior to the digital camera. But you created the digital camera, and you decided, though, that that was counterintuitive to how good the business was running today.
Right.
So you took the data, regardless of how important you thought it was, and said, we're going to build walls around this so nobody knows about it. And essentially, you destroyed your entire business in the next 20 plus years. One of the, like, the ability to pivot. And this is where there's so many different levels of data, right, that the business can use. But it even goes back to manufacturing, because as you put all those pokey oaks and all those checks in place, you can call them security checks in place, as the business evolves, as the next, you know, 4 years of the major model change comes and you're producing something different, you don't just go buy a whole new set of tools. You take the information that you had before, the checks that you had in place, and the things that you accomplish. And that is also data, right? Data right. points. And you try to improve upon them, right? So, and that goes right back to what you're saying, Eric, about it is constant change, but it's also constant improvement. And with the right leadership, I think also, I'm not saying not report to the CIO, because I think with the right leadership, that happens and should happen naturally in an organization. And then your pokey oak's there to make sure that the bad things aren't happening are some of the compliance, right? Some of the audits, right? Because those then hearken to a different group, maybe legal, et cetera.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think we've thrown it out, brought it back to Japanese culture yet either. So, I mean, throwing out the whole concept of Kaizen, right? Continual improvement. So throwing that out there. I mean, that's got to be an overarching kind of theme. And since we're listing some of the books, I mean, one that I really like was Innovator's Dilemma. And one of the things I think as we look at, and that was more generalistic about companies, but if we take that and reframe it in the context of a security program, we have to be careful on how we're defining success and how that applies to new endeavors, right? If we're the way we define success today is good, should be good for what the program looks today. But if we just try to carry over those KPIs, those metrics to what we need to build for tomorrow, we may show it as no longer being a success and may force us to miss the bigger picture and the evolving risk.
And just to come back to something you mentioned earlier, Eric, the idea of the of sunk cost, it's as modern leaders, the idea, this sunk cost fallacy that, you know, I have a car, I've already put $1,000 into the car, I don't want to get rid of the car because I've already put this money into it, so I'll keep throwing money at it. That exists not just in, you know, in the physical realm, it exists in, you know, the technical realm as well. And I am a big supporter of, you know, burn it down and rebuild it back better, stronger, because not just because we threw a lot of money at the old thing. You can keep there, you can absolutely keep throwing good money at bad, but there are times when you just need to start it over and take what you've learned as your outcome from the first iteration, even if all the investment that went into it can't be taken out of it.
I like that you said you are willing to burn it down. I was
absolutely,
as you maybe, were talking,
maybe a little too much,
but
that's my architect mind. It's, we can do this better. And sometimes you get into a game of chess and then there's no way left to win. Yes, you want to play it all the way through because that's how games and competition works. But this isn't competition. This is, you get to a point where you say there is no reasonable path to get to a good place. So let's start the game over.
And for all the security listeners out there, it may be, it's easy for Brian to say this, and any listener out there would be like, but Brian, you haven't sat a day in my shoes. But if I go back to my manufacturing days, I can say that I've experienced this in the manufacturing side. As you get down a path and you're working on a project or a program or whatever you're doing, and maybe you already have investments made, the second you realize that either A, maybe these investments that were in place prior to you getting there were not the right investments, right? Or if you're trying to solve one problem over here, but that problem is systemic to something that's already been done over here, right? It's that root cause analysis, that 5-why, going back and saying, you know, naze naze, why this, and then answer that and get all the whys out. Because maybe it does involve saying, I do have to burn this part of what's already been done to the ground. Maybe I have to burn this product to the ground. Maybe this process to the ground. Maybe we do need more people, right? And be able to put it out there. And if management can't accept that, then they need to be able to accept the risk. But it somehow needs to be put out there, transparent, and why you want to burn it to the ground.
Right. Transparency at the core of everything you do, right? But I you know, I think about, if I was to look this in a visual way, I think we've all seen the kind of the linear connected hills, right, of growth, that we say the organization is on this hill, our next leap, and these are, you know, multi-year milestones. Now we need to go up one step. And there's we've got to recognize, and this goes back to, you know, like it or not, there's, you know, components of Jack Welch, right? And some of the things that he did, realizing where the organization had to be, that you have to understand what are the objectives there And are the people, technology, whatever else is in that bucket, is it enough to get me to the top of that next hill? And if it's not, then you've got to be willing to make decisions as a leader to tear down architectures, to retool, retrain people, get new people on the bus. Sometimes you have to make some of those bigger changes to get to the next level.
And so if we bring this back around to the point on data, and data, you know, data at the center of the security realm of securing things, how does one go about bringing the idea of, we have this bolus of data, this corpus of data, and we need to change how we protect it from the inside out? Because the more I ponder that listener's comment, the more I'm thinking of ways to bring this to an organization that might need it. And I'm curious on both of your thoughts on how you'd start to approach it. And when you're done, I'm happy to share mine.
Yeah. First, from my perspective, first and foremost, it's not an IT or a security conversation. That's not being driven out of security. I think I see our role in this almost being a little bit of inception. You're planting the idea into somebody else's mind who understands the data, the process that is their day-to-day job. And then that starts to grow into more, right? So for instance, I'll take a look at what we're doing in the product engineering side, helping the product engineering team. You know, if you look at that group, they've spent a lot of time coming up with new ideas that they've patented. And I almost feel like that's their equivalent of our certificates. Like that's their level of medals, right? The number of patents they have. Mm-hmm. Reframing the conversation that, what if somebody just took what you patented and was able to reproduce it overseas where that patent really doesn't mean anything? And all of a sudden, kind of a light bulb comes off that, wow, I've worked really hard to create this. I don't want somebody just sweeping in and taking that. And now it almost became personal for them. And they start to understand why it's important to classify and build controls around that key data. But again, it's got to be driven out of the business. If you try to drive it from an IT perspective and bring the business along, they're not going to come because they won't see the value.
So I partially agree, but I disagree fundamentally that the role of information security is distinct from the rest of the business, of the business. And this us and them discussion is one that has been, you know, many years in the making, but I think that its time is long past. Security is business.
Agreed.
Not the business, but security is business. But I do agree that the idea of, you know, that it is the role of an information security organization to poke and highlight, be the baby proofer who comes right in and prepares. I feel this going to become one of those analogies I'll regret having started, but let's see where it goes. The baby proofer who comes in and points out and says, this thing will kill your baby and this thing will kill your baby and your baby could roll down the stairs. And if you don't put this gate up, but put it in, putting it in a way that makes the soon to be parent, able to understand and make some definitions as to the places where they think it's most important to do so. But that idea that it's an outside entity, and this is where the analogy fails, the idea that that's an outside entity coming in rather than one that is already deeply embedded in the flow and process of the organization, of the thing that makes the business make money. I think that's where this has historically fallen down. And by breaking that down and being more deeply part of the way features come out, the way processes developed, it means that you're not an outside party assessing, you are defining from within. And I think that is where we need to move as an industry, as a security industry, is making more of that deep integration. Now, that said, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I wholeheartedly agree. I think it's just a difference in macro versus micro looking at how this is all coming together, right? At a macro level, security is part of the business. I think we've all
it's
changed.
It's not always seen that way, though, within organizations. And security leaders haven't always gone out of our way to ensure that we were part of the discussions. It was, oh, we got to run the decision. Let's go call security. It versus, us saying, you know, here are the reasons why it's important that we're part of these discussions from the early right. stages.
But I feel like that's shifting.
Yeah, it is, but it's not quite 50-50. It is shifting, but it's not there yet.
Because I think from a board level, I think board members are starting to get this more and more. So for instance, last board meeting, we got the question if we have explicitly built into our awareness training, and this is risk holistically, not just security risk, but within all of the training, the understanding that associates are accountable for these risks, that is part of their job. So I, from a board level, I think they're getting it and you're seeing some of that transition down in the company. Yeah, it's not holistically across every company. But so where I was going with it is the security business break on a micro level. And when I say micro level, I'm talking about kind of a RASi chart. That if we look at the accountability for the data, ultimately security is not accountable for that data. We don't own that data.
Correct.
We don't take on the risk, we advise on the risk.
Yeah.
Right. And that's exactly it. And that's the perspective that we have to be an advisor to them, helping them understand. But at the end of the day, it is not our decision to tell them, here's how you're going to engineer, here's how you're going to create that data. That is a business-driven function that we can advise on.
So one thing both of you guys are referring to, though, in what you're talking about is also the culture of a company. And it, depending on what culture you're around, Eric, the mindset is changing. But I can tell you that in automotive pivoting, there's several different cultures around the world that build parts. And the culture of some of these companies do not embrace the security mindset of security from a cyber side. They're very much focused on the security of producing good parts, et cetera. And in even recent conversations, some of them don't even have CISOs and they have a CIO. And in most recent conversation, a CIO told me that, Brian, no matter what I put out there, it's not because I'm American. It's not because of an indifference in culture. It's an overall mindset of where the business has been for X number of years, that it's almost better that we pay additional money for a consultant to come in and tell us what we need to do to validate what I'm saying, because we can put it out there and eyes just go big. But when the consultants come in and it's several different consultant companies from different regions around the world are all saying the same thing, all of a sudden the business begins to buy into it. Sure. And I was like,
and that's been the case for decades and decades, and I don't think it'll go away. But what that is what the difference is, though, is that you now have, I'll relate to a slightly different process, but bear with me. The idea of outsourcing anything. I had a person I worked for many years ago who ran a service desk and did an amazing job of it. And his mantra was, you can't outsource your mess for less. And so the idea that you had to spend the time to understand what you've got and need before you outsource it. And I think that absolutely translates to the recommendations that you get from a third party in these kinds of assessments. You should walk as an information security leader, as an IT leader, you should walk in knowing, unless you're doing an initial gap analysis because you're understaffed and you need this view, this quick view, that's a slightly different case. But if you're trying to pose these things as a consultant who comes in to say, this is where we need to go, then you really should have an understanding of that before you bring the consultant in, and the consultant becomes confirmatory.
Right.
And becomes that voice because you know that's what the culture needs in order to have them listen. If at all possible, that should be their response should echo yours.
Well, it's like a lawyer in the doing the cross, right? That don't ask a question you don't know, I already know the answer.
Absolutely.
To. You want to control that. But I don't think this is only limited to smaller manufacturing, smaller companies. Mm-mm. I think everybody at some point is in that boat. And that's why I will maintain that I think one of the best friends to a CISO is the audit function within an organization.
Hear, hear.
Because if you can partner on that, audit can make that now it's not just me as the CISO having a conversation, send you an email. Now that's an official finding. And now that it's an official finding, there are processes. It goes up to audit committee. It has visibility across the executive team. And I think there's got to be a healthy partnership there.
Yeah, without question. And that's outside consulting, but not necessarily outside the organization.
Right.
And, you know, Brian, the one thing I will say is every once in a while, it is helpful to get somebody from outside to look at things, not because of the idea that the salesman of the idea or the one who can convince certain groups, but rather that there is, you can be too close to it. It is possible to be too close to stuff, and having that outside view every once in a while is a really good idea, but you shouldn't do that as the way to sell something. That should be an informative and advisory rather than a confirmatory engagement. They're very, I would go at them very differently.
Yeah. And I mean, I would take it up a level and say that it's a necessity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having that outside perspective every once in a while, it's very easy to get myopic and just, we've done things. You don't see it any of the ways. It's the tree versus the forest analogy, right?
Yeah.
And it's super critical in how the fast paced changing dynamics of security, mobility, pick your buzzword, that you have that outside perspective that is removed from day-to-day activities.
No, I appreciate that. One thing I was going to mention or just go back on when you were talking about audit and how that can help basically drive change. I was just talking with someone literally yesterday, very, very, very large company. And he said that the biggest changes that their company went through was about 10 to 15 years ago, but it was all driven from, you know, if we're really going to make the business change, how can we do that? And it started with audit, and it started with ways to be able to show there's all these problems that were coming up, but they were always being found by audit. And eventually the management said, these are some pretty big problems. And the way it was explained to me was, instead of just doing the audit, right, like proving that there's a problem, we also had to come with the solution. Because if we just came with the problem, everyone was going to say, well, what do we need to do? And that was going to be a much longer conversation. But if we came with the problem and the solution, it was immediate, okay, go fix the problem. Because we were starting to fail all the time, every time something was looked at from an audit perspective. And eventually management said, I want IT to find these things, not my audit team after the fact. So then it was, let's start building these things in place so we're catching them before they go out.
Right.
And as he was talking, and you guys were just talking, it brought back the idea of building in the process checks, the pokey oaks into assembly, et cetera, all those things you were doing. And this was a very old company and a very large company. So it was a painful process at first, but it eventually changed the culture of the company and how they looked at security and building security in. It was kind of confirming at the end of the day, even the very large companies can do it, right? But it does take leadership, right? And it takes someone to say that we're going to do this because it will slow things down, right? And this, again, a company that you can never stop production. You can never stop, whether it's building parts or stop production from a dev side. You can't stop production. And to say that we're going to have to do that in order to put certain things in place as we find them, everyone said this will never work, right? Well, it will work if somebody says you can stop it, right? And Eric, this goes back to pulling the on-dog cord. If it's put there, but you're so afraid to do it because you know management doesn't want you to, you're never going to pull it.
Right.
And you're never going to improve. And until the leadership says we can pull the cord and we can stop, right? And that'll build confidence up in everyone to do a better job, but also knowing that you're going to get faster. Short-term pains, long-term gains.
Yeah, it all comes back to culture then again, doesn't it? That, you know, establishing the culture that these are, you know, that it is okay to not just continue on the path. It is okay to burn things down within reason. Yeah, controlled burns.
And I think, Brian, to your point, though, it's also kind of a framing. You know, if we frame it in the context that it's going to slow things down, then there's a negative term associated with it. But if we look at it, you know, the look at what quality and safety have brought to the manufacturing side, right? That, all right, the line may slow down a little bit, but our defects are lower, which in turn means we have less returns. It costs us less money in the long run. So I think it's all about packaging and what that looks like. And I mean, in all honesty, I think staying away from some of those terms on slow down, creating more process, anything, it's helping the organization see the bigger picture, the longer journey down the road.
I would also like to point out too, for those that say, you know, peel back the onion, understand that there are several different types of onions, right? And when you get into saying, you know, red onion, sweet onion, yellow onion, even the size of them, when you go to cut it open, to be able to peel that layer back is tough. And then you get into the idea of leaks, right? And
leeks, L-E-A-K-S, or leeks, L-E-E-K-S?
L-E-E-K-S. And great for, like, if you're doing like a French onion soup, right? Three different types of onions, get some leeks in there, roast them for an hour. That last 15 minutes will squeeze a garlic, right? Put them back in uncovered, caramelized, right? Now you're peeling back an onion and finding a different way to cook it and extract all that good flavor out of it. But that leek, when you go ahead and cut off all the green, in order to peel it back, you have to cut the onion entirely in half. And when you peel back those layers, you'll see that there's levels of grit in there. There's levels of dirt that you have to wash out before you chop up the leek to go ahead and cook it, right? And another onion, you know, that sweet onion, once that outside layer is there, you're just chopping and going. But if you don't understand that, then your finished product is going to have grit in it. And everybody that eats it is going to get that crunch. And what you've developed is a soup that you eventually have to throw out. So peeling back the onion, you have to understand what onion you're peeling back, because everyone is different and the quality controls put in place will be different. So it does matter who the cook is and what the recipe is you're following.
And as a follow-on on that, I was handed an interesting article, I think by my father this week, that says, you know, how it talks about how emotionally intelligent people use the emergency exit rule to win almost every argument. And so you think about the context of the organization and how you try to position this kind of change or an approach, and using, I'll read a quick quote. People who have high emotional intelligence understand that if you want to be more persuasive and even win most arguments, it's important to do two things. Avoid distracting emotional mini controversies and offer easy ways for people to overcome emotional objections and more easily follow the path you want them to take. So you talk about the positives. I know you're very busy. This is why people often say, you know, I know you're really busy, but I'd really like to get 5 minutes. You know, it's an acknowledgement of something positive about them, something that makes them feel good and important. And then the ask, we know you walked out of the store. The police do this all the time in interviews. Attorneys do this in cross-examination in order to get to the right answer, in order to position the question in a way that gets an answer. And I think in closing, you know, we're coming upon the end of the hour. In closing, we talk about ways that we as security professionals can help to drive the culture of an organization, help to get the backing and support to implement these kinds of changes or controlled burn downs, or the ability to say we need to stop what we're doing and look at something slightly different. This is a technique that has, you know, when I read the article, I realized that there's many things in here that I do, and many things that I know that I've seen both of you do as we have these kind of debates and discussions, in order to get a point across in a way that somebody on the other side is ready and willing to listen. It's an interesting piece, and I'll put it in the show notes. We'd love your comments on it, and we'd love your comments on the entire episode and the topic of protecting data first versus data out versus infrastructure in. We'd love your feedback on other topic ideas for future episodes. You can find us at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net, on Twitter @securitydebate, or on our website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net. We have a YouTube channel, and we'd love for you to go there and watch the visual version in which you can see my face react every time Brian starts to talk about automotive, and I look shocked because how could we go to automotive yet again? or it's just a fun way to put visual around the audio podcast. Or you can find us always, of course, in your favorite audio podcast application. Brian, Eric, thanks again for another great debate. And to listeners, thank you for being here. We look forward to seeing you again on the next Great Security Debate.